Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is a writer, a journalist, and an adventurer. Born in Britain, he grew up riding a bicycle and in his mid-20s, having cycled a half a dozen times across Europe to his second nation of Turkey, he broke a world record for riding around the world by bike, over 18,000 miles through 20 countries in 169 days. He's won the UK's Dolman Travel Writing Award for an account of a hitchhike journey through Middle America. He's travelled by boat to remote islands in Asia, chronicling a world and people at the edge of modernity. He combines a background in political science to create a critically acclaimed travel writing style, Politics at Roadsides. In this way, and in writing and talks, he uses human stories and the perspective of travel to document global issues for a broad audience. Julian Sayre, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, a cycling childhood, very much a focus of your growing up. Tell me about those early years.
I think it always comes down to one memory of age 10 and being a bit bored on a Saturday afternoon. I grew up in the Midlands and my grandparents lived about 10 miles away. But most of it was along a Roman road called the Fossway, so there weren't too many turns involved. And I quite liked riding my bike. And I was 10 and I asked my mum, can I ride to grandma and granddad's? And I'm still very grateful to her for the fact that she said yes, because we went through which turnings of left-right I needed to take to get out of the village, and I set off on my way. An hour later, I'd arrived, much to the surprise of my grandparents, because I'd obviously always turned up in the past with my mum and with my brother and sister. So I'm still very grateful to my mum for trusting me in that journey, and I think the independence of it, the sort of knowledge that I could travel under my own steam, really stayed with me. I remember the conversation I had at my grandparents that day over lunch was much more grown up. I talked about school, I talked about my parents' relationship and how that was going. And it remains one of the things that I think is really important about cycling for young people and for kids, because it gives you that independence and a little bit of adventure. And it sort of stayed with me. So I started riding further and further away out of the county of Leicestershire into Warwickshire. Age 19, by that point I was smitten with professional cycling, wanted to ride the Tour de France one day sort of thing. Age 19 I rode to Lisbon, and then a few years after that to Istanbul, back from Istanbul via a boat from Ukraine. You get the boat from Istanbul to Odessa in those days. So just always travelling on the bike and just affirming this amazing way of seeing the world and this amazing reaction that people always had to me. I think there's something about the bicycle that really brings out the best in people. It reminds them of a younger self, a younger version of themselves. I mean, just the architecture of the bicycle is very sort of open as opposed to a car, which is so shut away, and especially in sort of poorer countries can come with these connotations of wealth and detachment. So yeah, I really kind of credit the biker a lot with sort of opening the world up to me in that way.
And you must have a very personal relationship with each machine that you have.
Bicycles are generally known to be a bit of an N plus one phenomena, where the correct number is always one more than that which you already have. I think I've got three, one of which is a road bike. I got a city bike. And then, yeah, I got a touring bike made by a really good husband and wife team down in the Black Forest of Germany. And they've been good enough to sponsor me over the years with the circumnavigation and with riding across Europe and just looking after me.
And so when you give bikes away, and I know you've done this, you've ridden to a refugee camp in Calais and actually left your bicycle behind. It must be quite a wrench. It is a bike that you do have a hold to, that has a hold on you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was an article I wrote for The Guardian a few years back, and their title was slightly misleading in that it wasn't actually my bicycle. I mean, the story behind that is nevertheless even nicer in some ways. I think a bike ride with myself had been auctioned off at a charity event, and the guy that I went up on that ride with is an ex-oil worker. And we got on well. He works in renewable energy now, so he's had his sort of Damascene conversion. But ex-oil worker, and he said as we were parting, he had a garage full of bikes that his wife would be only too happy to see the back of a few of. And he had one that was an old one that he'd ridden around the enormous sort of oil fields of Houston on. So when in 2015, when the refugee crisis really exploded, there was a call out for people to ride bikes to Calais. The jungle camp was sort of 5 miles out of central Calais, and so a 5 mile walk is a couple of hours just to get your basic provisions, your food and your water, is a lot for the people living in the camp to do. And a bicycle really transforms that journey. So got in touch with the guy and asked if he'd still be up for giving me one of his bikes. And I took it, and this bike that had once ridden around the oil fields of Houston, lived in a garage in Surrey. I then rode through the night down through Kent to Dover and then to Calais, and gave it to, I think it was an Eritrean guy and his girlfriend or wife. And that was that.
So you have ridden across the world. In fact, you're a record holder. Tell me about this, because you've documented all of this in a book called Life Cycles. A London bike courier decided to cycle around the world 169 days later. He came back with a world record.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost 10 years ago now. And sort of enough time has elapsed that I can feel proud of it, because I'm almost a bit taken aback that I did such a thing. It's obviously, you know, quite an undertaking. I mean, the record's been broken a couple of times since. It's gone backwards and forwards. The main reason I did it, you know, as I say, I cycled a few times to Istanbul. I'd probably put away about 70 miles a day. You know, you wake up pretty much with the sun, you ride until lunchtime and all the heat of the day. In my case, I'd ride for a few hours and then get back on the bike. And you can really travel a long way when that's all you're doing in the day. And so that was 70 miles. And then this very corporate attempt at the record came along, and the guy did it in 90 miles a day average and made it look very miserable. That was my real objection to it. It showed all of the things that go wrong, these very daunting preparations of cardiovascular testing and fat tanks and whatever. And also this corporatization of it, you know, all of the images of the open road, the sunset, the poor farmer who gives you water when you need it, and lent to investment funds and banks. And it was just coming out of the financial crisis having just hit. We just bailed out all these banks. I was a student of political science, as was the other guy. I really believed then, and believe actually in some ways even more passionately now, maybe more calmly. But, you know, we need to keep something sacred in this world. And travel shows you some of those things, all of these images of human kindness, natural beauty. And as soon as they're repackaged and repurposed just as part of an advertising campaign for a bank or an investment fund that really is only about the bottom line, I think we as a society, as a species, kind of have to ask, are we getting into sort of dangerous territory? We're willing to sell everything away in such a way. So yeah, I set off to break the record. It was only 20 miles a day average more than what I'd done. I felt I could probably do it while still having a good amount of fun, which I did. The most I rode in a day was probably 220 miles or something like that. A very steady average of 100 miles a day was, for the most part, pretty attainable for the last month, because I'd probably had too much fun and too much talking about guns and God and abortion rights in the United States. I was a bit behind schedule, and so I was riding 150 mile a day average. But yeah, I mean, the numbers of 169 days total, I think my daily budget was €10. Whenever I do a talk about the event, I always start out with the numbers, because really it was the human stories, you know, the people that helped me out at the roadside, whether that's an evangelical Christian in Texas who spent an hour looking for a crank in his garage for me after my crank snapped, or whether it's having heat exhaustion in the middle of the Kazakh steppe, and when you happen across the first house for 100 miles, the guy standing outside of it just ushers you straight in and makes up a room for you and says, come lie down and rest. So it's a beautiful way to travel. And I've travelled so much now, I guess, you know, some of the things you mentioned in the Andaman Sea with the Moken Sea Gypsies and what have you, and it's taken a while for me to stop simply identifying as a young lad who grew up in Leicester, who's essentially just, I've been mesmerised, really, by so much of what I've seen. And, yeah, I feel really privileged at being able to write about it. Yeah.
The way that you're received by people, you talk about the great kindness of people as you were on your bike, and particularly across America, a lot of people receiving you in a very generous way. But a few years later, you undertook another journey across America, and this time you were hitchhiking, and people's attitude to you was entirely different.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was the story of the book Interstate. And yeah, it was one of the big shocks I had, really, setting out. I'd gone initially to the US to work on a documentary project, cut my ties with London and sublet my room for a couple of months. So when this documentary project in New York fell through, I had nothing more. I had nowhere else to be. And I was already in the United States. So I thought, in a quite timeless American fashion, you know, well, I'm a travel writer, I should probably hitchhike to California. So that's what I did. As a cyclist in the United States, I'd always been presumed to be homeless, because Americans are a very car-centric country and they can't imagine that anyone would be cycling, or certainly not cycling across the country just for the joy of it. So I'd been assumed homeless, but nonetheless received with a great warmth, people literally winding down their car windows, and one woman giving me $10 a cyclist in LA. He wanted to ride back to his house with him and take a photo. And after a bit of insisting, I said yes. And then when we got to the house, he took a photo, gave me a bag as a sort of like picnic for my lunch, and then stuffed $100 into my pocket. And so all of this, retrospectively, having hitchhiked, I think that cycling sort of appeals to this bootstrapping sort of American spirit where they think you're homeless, but you're really doing something amazing. You're picking yourself up. And in fairness, that is the truth of a lot of the guys cycling across the United States. There are tramps who basically get themselves a bicycle, especially if they're from the northern states. They'll cycle south for winter to get away from the snow and from the cold. And yeah, I mean, I guess with this politics of roadsides, that kind of human migration driven by poverty and sort of destitution is really one of the things that's very impacting of the American experience at the roadsides. But yeah, hitchhiking, it was funny because I'd expected to receive at least a similar level of warmth, and I found myself instead to be this just left at the roadsides and presumed to be mentally unstable, presumed to be dangerous, presumed not just to be poor, but also all of these other connotations that I might be sort of unsafe or dirty or anything like that. Yeah, it was hard. I think much as the Americans are often an incredibly generous and warm-hearted, hospitable people, I think they have such an underclass that if it's assumed that you've fallen out the bottom of society, there's a good number of people that really feel no need to extend even the basic manners that I think travelling in Europe or in the Middle East have never really come across. A rudeness that people felt entitled to dispense my way when they assumed that I might have been homeless or poor beyond normal amount.
As you say, this is documented in the book Interstate, and it was, for me, I mean, a real eye-opener. It's a beautifully, beautifully written book, but it's also a complete shock, really, to read about the so-called flyover state and really the people that live there who you can quite see why that anger and that feeling of disenfranchisement has given rise to Trump. I mean, I was really, really shocked by what almost in lots of ways seems a different species from those people living on either coast.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I talk about being left at roadsides and presumed to be mentally unwell. The reaction I received as a hitchhiker was very difficult, but actually often I could understand it. You know, there are great swathes of America where there are people who, if they were in Europe, would maybe be in some sort of secure housing or receiving professional help, and they are literally hitchhiking to California to stay warm at winter time. You know, so it is a very much decaying country, I think, and you know, you won't get sight of that in Manhattan or San Francisco, not that, of course, these cities have their pockets of extreme poverty. But yeah, the reality of the roads and articulated lorries with come drive for us, 1 cent a mile stickers on the back. There's this road poverty that you come across, and whether that's manifested in the truck stops where there's no vitamins or no fresh fruit, no vegetables, or the toys that the truckers are buying as absent fathers for their kids back home being very martial and its tanks and its guns. It's very important for the world, for America. I did the journey in 2013. It was 5 years into Obama presidencies. And it's very important to see Trump very much as a symptom of what's wrong with America anyway. This idea that he's in some way an aberration from the American norm, and that these polite old Texan men like George W. Bush, who nevertheless took people off to war or indiscretions around the Florida election or massive tax cuts for the rich. Trump is everything that is, as I see it, business as usual in America, but only declaring itself openly. And actually, I think for anyone who's genuinely motivated to improve the world and the conditions that gave rise to Trump, I almost think that he's an alarm, essentially. You know, it's not too late to reverse these things, but it is going to take a massive investment in society and education and the sort of business as usual that America in particular takes for media, news reporting, social security. It will simply produce more Trumps.
Well, I would urge people to read this book. As I say, it completely opened my eyes and really made me understand and see, I think, for the first time that these people existed, and they exist really without any state support. There is no kind of welfare system for them, and you can quite see why they are where they are. You came back to England and you have been, obviously you're a writer, but you also worked as a cycle courier. Now that, of course, again, a very low-paid job and not one at the higher echelons of society. Tell me about that experience and, of course, the book, which is called Messengers.
Yeah, I mean, on and off, I was a courier for 3 years. With hindsight, everything looks a bit nicer, just as George W. Bush. But at the time, it was a very difficult, precarious thing. You're cycling across London for £2.50 a delivery on average. The dream is when you get three things in your bag, and so you got £7.50 for one traversal of the city, maybe. When you're in the city in the square mile and you find out you have to go to the West End with just one thing on board and it's going to be £2.50 and maybe it's raining or cold. It was a tough existence. You do get the moments of euphoria where you're going against the clock and you've been told you've got a deadline to meet. And can you make it down to Piccadilly in 17 minutes from Holborn, or from actually Holborn to Piccadilly in 17 minutes would be pretty slow, but you get my point. And there's a real camaraderie as well of all of the other guys who are out in the city coming in over the radio. And you're all sort of involved in this semi-visible machine that is kind of making a city tick. You know, when the financial crisis hit, I had three deliveries, which was quite good, of receivership notices going out to Lehman Brothers. So, again, this kind of quite interesting perspective on the world economy where I would have been paid three lots of £2.50 to deliver receivership notices from three banks in the city out to Canary Wharf on liabilities of the 30 billion or whatever it was that Lehman had lost. So yeah, that kind of perspective of not only of being a sort of graduate, initially, if I'm honest, I'd got into couriering thinking I might make a bit more of a half-decent living than proved to be the case, which I think is what everyone does when they start out as a courier and then you just end up stuck in it, especially if you like cycling, basically, because it is an interesting way to watch the city. It was eye-opening as well, because most people, and I still see some of the guys that I would have couriered with, this is the best part of 10 years ago now, and I still see them and they've still got their old beat-up bags, maybe even the same bag, because you had something like a Royal Mail post sack that had found its way to you and they were well made, so you keep them. And I'll still see some of those guys on the streets.
And what sort of people are they?
It's a mixed bag. I mean, there's a little cottage industry of us graduates that have written our little books about being a courier in London. And there is that, you know, there's the well-meaning idealist who just wants to ride the bike and watch the city. Then there's the jailbirds, the guys that maybe because they've been in jail, you know, can't get other jobs necessarily or so easily, or they have difficulties maybe even getting bank accounts, all the kind of the sort of life problems that if you're in any sort of remotely middle class position, you take for granted. But people who need basically that flexibility of a company that will pay you with a check that you can then go and cash and obviously lose 10% of your wages right away because you have to cash it because you can't bank it. I was with a courier who at the weekends worked as a bailiff as well. And I was with another guy who had big debts from his cocaine problem. And the bailiff would have advised the guy with debts how to avoid bailiffs. So it's very unseen. And I did it at a time when I wasn't able to get the graduate jobs that I would have initially wanted, something, you know, quite well-meaning and campaigning or charity. I realise now it was never going to be my life always, but at the time it kind of felt like that. So I do think it's kind of an important perspective for people to experience maybe at one point in their life when you're stuck with the reality of, shit, is this it? And yeah, as I say, a lot of the guys that I rode with are still out there. 50 quid a day, 60 quid a day was your benchmark for what a good day's work was. And that would have been from leaving your house at 8 in the morning and getting back at 6 in the evening and hoping when you live in Hackney or in Walthamstow that the last delivery you're left with isn't on Pall Mall or in Paddington, basically.
Well, your most recent book is called All at Sea. It's your fourth book, and it's about your travels in Thailand and the people that you met there, back to your whole kind of roadside politics theme. Tell us about that journey.
I mean, as with the initial showing up in the United States at the time of Interstate, that was me being recruited as a writer on a documentary project, which was very well-meaning but very poorly organised. But there's a tribe, a community of people called the Moken, who are known as sea gypsies, and they live in the waters between Myanmar and Thailand. They have a very simple traditional existence that is increasingly under threat from mass tourism, from oil and gas exploration in the region, from industrial logging, from industrial fishing. Meanwhile, they're caught in the net themselves of a lot of conservation legislation. So whereas you will have the industrial logging companies felling trees, these guys that would fell one to build their traditional boats aren't necessarily allowed to. They're not allowed to catch a surplus of fish to trade while the trawlers are out there in the seas taking everything. So it's very much this unique and from the outside very pure existence of humans in harmony with nature, and yet a way of life that we will romanticise, but that is essentially being driven towards extinction by a lot of what goes for normal in a modern economy.
Mm.
And so I was just watching their way of life, and in some ways watching the documentary crew as they moved amongst them, and sort of asking these questions of what are we looking for when we look at Indigenous peoples in this sort of way? Are we looking for a sort of a salve to our conscience so that we back in urban society can believe that somewhere out there life is still pure and humans are still existing as we would like?
This whole way of looking at the world by getting in there with people who are really experiencing the basis form of living has given rise to your way of writing.
Yeah.
It makes it possible to see life in a completely different way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm growing into myself as a writer, and I think I'm getting comfortable with dabbling between genres. I fell in love with writing really through reading classics. So that was always my ideal of what literature and books was going to be. I think in the same way as journalism, I want to write something that people can sort of like pick up and learn something about the world. And then sometimes there are some ideas from universities and academia that I think need to be popularised. I mean, in the United States, there was this quite seminal study from Case and Deaton, which explains the rising morbidity and mortality of white America, essentially, and it's the opioid crisis and its suicide rates. And it's an academic study, but it really underpins so much of what we see in Trump. So in terms of having a real fidelity to the written word and wanting it to be beautiful, in terms of wanting to sort of raise an alarm, if you like, on the world as I've feel fortunate to have seen it at the sort of close quarters that I have. It sort of all comes together, and yeah, I feel really privileged that I'm able to write books and that people read them. And yeah, I still have this an identity of myself as a younger person wanting to be a writer and growing up in the Midlands and surrounded by a world that was kind of quite boring. It's closed down factories. It was avoiding fights on a Friday night if you go out for some underage drinking in the local town. And actually myself and friends in Istanbul, I've always said that the guys from the West that you get in Istanbul were people from Cincinnati, Ohio, from Michigan, myself from the Midlands, another guy there from Portsmouth. It's sort of the people from the unremarkable towns, I think, can often end up with this sort of curiosity for the world, because you have to go and find the world for yourself when you come from those places, maybe, in a way that you don't if you grew up with New York City on your doorstep, or even yeah, London or San Francisco.
As you say, you have dual heritage, Turkey too, and you've written about Turkey, you've written about the failed coup there, and you've also been writing about the Crown Prince, the Saudi Crown Prince, and of course both of those things have come together in this shocking recent story, the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Tell us a little bit about your writing around those subjects.
I think the more I write, I think I get drawn ever more towards the Middle East. As you say, I've got dual heritage of Turkey. I think in Western audiences we're conditioned with a massive lack of empathy, not to mention understanding of that region. I mean, a lot of people, I think even if you don't identify with a map of a region and what it looks like, how can people be expected to identify with the people living in those places? You know, if you can't see and visualise in your head the relationship of where they sit on a map, Egypt, Somalia, Saudi, Yemen, Oman, Iran, if you can't see that in some way, how do you care about the people in those places? And I think on the basis of a century of oil extraction and recycling the monies from that extraction and from that sale back into Western banks via the arms trade, we have allowed an absolute tyranny, a collective noun for tyrannies, to take root in that region, and quite at odds with the ambition and desires that the people there have for peace, for democracy, for federalism. And Western governments, UK in particular, have been very much complicit in all of that. And I think Western people, people who have maybe travelled a little in the region, I think will know that that isn't what anyone on the face of the earth wants, where you can be put in jail for signing an e-petition, these things we would take for granted.
Mm.
So to sort of popularise an understanding of that. I mean, it sounds silly even to say it, that people in Turkey or people in Iran are the same as people in the United Kingdom. Of course they are. And yet we exist in a culture of media norms where there's something striking about asserting that very basic fact. Mm. And so I think the Arab Spring and protests more recently in Iran, Turkey, all of these places are really a sign of what people in those regions want. They've been bombed by us. They're being bombed by their own leaders using our weapons. Companies will sell equipment to these regimes that is used for torture. We will give training to their police forces. It's really reprehensible. And we are very fortunate in our countries to walk safe streets and, as I say, take for granted the political participation that we're afforded. And I suppose in writing about the region, I really want to take a voice that exists in those countries, and maybe because I'm dual heritage and I know that Turkish people are the same as British people. Cultural differences, of course, that's what makes the world rich. But, yeah, they want the same things from their life. And I think it's great that in the last few years we have seen this rise of voices from people in the Middle East, activists who are spread around the region, who are maybe sometimes living in exile, a diaspora. And it's not going to go away. I mean, I see it actually overall as a very hopeful trend.
But when you look at America and you look at Europe, particularly Eastern Europe, and this huge rise of the right, where does that fit?
I think it fits in the same trend. I mean, the term identity politics is obviously very controversial. I think all politics is identity politics. I think we obviously have white identity politics. We are in a time where, because of massive globalization, in acceleration of technology, whether it's communication between individuals or communication from media, things have changed very much and very quickly, and I think it's natural for people to fear some of that. And then the elephant in the room of all of this, and when we make these things a conversation of a cultural clash, we miss that actually we're living through the highest level of wealth inequality in three centuries. You know, we're at a level of wealth inequality last seen in the Age of Revolution, 1789, the French Revolution. And that has an effect. And more statistic that 8 men now own half of the world's wealth. And there's a lack of willingness or hunger to scrutinise that. If 8 men don't own half of the world's wealth, then you are, and if that wealth is distributed equitably, you're much less likely to find yourself in a situation where you're finding these clashes of culture or people looking to their petty differences, and that actually often quite rich and nice differences, rather than seeing what they have in common and that actually everyone wants the same things. I think if we talk about that massive wealth inequality a little bit more, then we might find ourselves making headway with this situation rather faster.
And you explore these themes and many more with your view from the roadside in all of your fabulous books, which I've so enjoyed reading. And I must urge everybody to pick up copies. We have Life Cycles. That's all about your trip around the world. Interstate, Hitchhiking Through the State of a Nation. Messengers, about your time as a courier. And All at Sea. And these are published by Arcadia Books. Julian, thank you very much indeed. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the production team of George McDonough, Christy Evans, Martha Libri and Barbara Mimmoni. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.